Welcome to the Clubhouse with Shane Bacon. I am your host, Shane Bacon. Caught up on sleep. I feel a lot better after that crazy Open Championship. Had a podcast on Monday. If you didn't see that, make sure you go check it out. The great Scott Van Pelt joined us. We recapped the Open. We talked about Lynx Golf and the home of golf and how much fun it is to be over there. And obviously his time getting to broadcast and be a part of the coverage with ABC and ESPN over the years at the Open, changing this year over to NBC. But I wanted to expand a little bit on Phil Mickelson and, you know, Phil Mickelson's career and, you know, his longevity and how he's still a factor and still battling and still getting close to winning majors and potentially winning majors at 46 years old, which is, of course, the magic number in golf. I mean, when you think about 46, you know, you think about Jack Nicklaus in 1986. And, you know, again, that's the number that we seem to keep around. That's the number that seems to be the peak and the pinnacle. And I just believe that there's more to Phil Mickelson, and we can dive a little bit deeper, not only into this past week, but in his career and his major wins and his legacy and how much more he's got left in the tank. So Alan Shipnuck of SI and golf.com, the great golf writer, joined me, a guy that's been covering Phil for many, many, many years. He was on a drive and took some time, so I appreciate Alan doing that. Great conversation about Phil Mickelson. At the end, he gives two or three great Phil Mickelson stories, so make sure you stay around to the end for that. But just wanted to expand a little bit on Phil because I think he's such a unique character to the game of golf, to our sport. He's such an interesting ambassador. He's got a mind that is unlike anything or anybody else that's ever played golf, in my opinion. And it's just so much fun watching him get into these situations still, even in 2016. And, you know, I had people on Twitter call me out on this, but I still think that of all the names in golf, not Tiger Woods, Phil Mickelson is the most fun player when he's in a hunt at a major. I just think that the intrigue grows bigger than maybe golf fans see it as. So Alan's on, just talking a little Tiger to start. We talked Phil, we talked Olympics as Alan Shipnuck plans to go down to Rio and cover the first Olympics in however many years. So a good conversation, fun, just talking about Lefty and just rapping about the anomaly that is the 46-year-old. And we welcome into the clubhouse for the second time SportsIllustratedGolf.com's Alan Shipnuck, one of the better golf writers on the planet. You can follow him on Twitter at Alan Shipnuck. Alan, first of all, thanks for joining us. And second, you're driving across California.
I'm happy to be here. And I try and fit all my podcast into long trips down Highway 101. So this is perfect. it's a great state. You got to get out and see it once in a while. It's a nice day.
Yeah, and a couple of people I wanted to talk about, California guys. First things first, and I don't like to bring his name up because I think there's been so much good golf over the last 3 or 4 years, but Tiger Woods announced, you know, won't be at the PGA. He's hanging it up for the whole season. First of all, were you at all surprised, you know, when you heard this quote-unquote announcement come out yesterday?
No, not in the least. I've been saying all along a reasonable re-entry for Tiger is probably Torrey Pines or maybe the Honda. There was no advantage to rushing back to play in the hardest tournaments of the year when he's utterly unprepared. It doesn't make any sense. And other people have had similar back conditions. You know, a lot of them took a year plus before they even touched a club. So I think maybe for the first time, Tiger's being sensible and listening to his body and listening to his doctors. So it's not a surprise. The slow drip of announcement, I think, is interesting. It makes you wonder if it's driven by marketplace considerations. I mean, he has these contracts, and there needs to be the appearance that he's trying to get back, and he's trying to play this year. Otherwise, I don't know why he didn't just say it all along. So, as always with Tiger, there's a little intrigue, a little mystery. He's always enigmatic, but the fact that he's not going to play golf this year is really not a surprise to anyone who's been paying attention.
And you know, it comes on the heels of something interesting in a playoff of Tiger in health and age is a guy his same age wins his first major at the British Open on Sunday in Henrik Stenson, and that is juxtaposed with a guy that has won all of the majors and yet is unhealthy and can't play golf for the entire season. And that brings me to my second and hopefully final Tiger question before we get into the Open and Phil. But do you see a comeback from this guy? And what does a comeback look like from Tiger if and when he does decide to actually be a golfer again?
I think he has to try. It's just how he's hardwired. he doesn't want to limp into the sunset like this. Again, Tiger is going to live comfortably, but given his burn rate, given his alimony situation, I think he wants to keep those contracts going as long as possible. So he will try because he has to. But put it this way: if Tiger could come back and win a major, it'd be the greatest achievement of his career by a factor of 100. And if he even goes back and wins the Bob Hope, it's monumental. I mean, he's been at the absolute depths of despair with the chip yip, shooting 85 at the Memorial, all of the mental and metaphysical scars you see, and then just a broken body, at the three back surgeries and all of that. So I can see him back, playing a few tournaments, struggling to break par, and just ask himself, is this really worth it? Do I want to just keep doing this forever? He's been kicking the teeth for 2+ years in a row. He's obviously a man of immense pride. Nothing left to prove or play for. He's not going to get the Jack anyway. So, I could imagine the comeback would be very short-lived. He could go out under the cover of more back problems. Tiger always wanted to be a jock. He loved to talk about his injuries and all his Navy SEAL weirdness. I think it's a more heroic end for him if his body just broke, and to say that I just can't really play golf anymore. So when he does go, I'm sure there's going to be an injury that's going to be the reason. And given what his body's been through, it's pretty legitimate anyway. So I guess the bottom line is I'm not optimistic about any meaningful Tiger Woods golf in the future.
And we talk about a Tiger Woods is 40 years old. And then you look at Stenson winning. But more importantly, and kind of what I wanted to focus on with you today is Phil Mickelson, a 46-year-old guy, hasn't won an event since 2013 at this same British Open. Yet, I would say that this has been one of the more impressive seasons he's had in a long time, even without the win. I mean, he's put himself in contention, seems to be a lot more focused on his golf game. So I just wanted to get into Phil for a little bit. I know you know him, you've written about him plenty of times. But where does this rank Phil Mickelson's second-place performance in the history of golf, of all second place performances? Where does Phil's play for 4 days rank as guys that didn't get it done?
Well, it ranks right up there with the 2015 Masters, when he shot a score that would have won almost every other Jack in history. He's been snake bit now here, where he's played tremendous golf, and he's just been beaten by something that's transcendent. So, his play at Valhalla when Rory won in 2014, Phil played terrific golf too. So he hasn't been giving these majors away. He's just been beaten by guys who are playing out of their minds. It's certainly, the fact that he's 46, that there's always going to be resonance to Jack Nicklaus's age. If Phil could have gotten it done, it would have ranked right up there with what Jack did. But just to finish off the Tiger bit, I mean, Tiger used to love to make fun of Phil's body. He'd make fun of, the kids and Amy running onto the green and all the family values. It's really interesting how it's kind of flipped. Phil's gotten the last laugh. He didn't push his body to the limit, the gym, and the Fort Bragg. And he didn't indulge in all the extracurricular stuff. He didn't chase the dollars all around the world and scoop up every endorsement deal. And we're really seeing at the back end of his career that's paid off, that he really made all the right choices. Here he is. Not only is he playing well, he pretty much clinched his Ryder Cup spot. He's become the godfather to the U.S. team. He's become a mentor to this whole generation of Spieths and Fowlers. And he's become this beloved elder statesman. And all these things have been denied Tiger. I mean, Tiger's going to be driving around in a cart watching Phil hit golf shots at the Ryder Cup. He's 6 years younger. So there's definitely a parable there somewhere. And don't think that Phil's not aware of it, and Tiger too. But, to your point, Phil's talked a lot in the last few years about taking better care of himself. He's given up red meat, starts every day with this green juice shake that his chef makes him. He's gotten into kickboxing and any number of other aerobic activities to keep him fit, but also keep him flexible. And he's more excited than I've seen him in a long time between the ropes. You know, these swing changes he's worked on has really energized him. And I don't think this was the last gasp by any means. I could certainly imagine him contending at future major championships. And obviously, he needs to prove he can close the tournament out. He's in that danger zone now in the mid-40s where guys stop winning, and that's happened to him. But if he, as we said before, he's playing great. If he just keeps throwing himself in contention, he's got to pick one of these off.
And, you know, to that point, I mean, do you think for Phil Mickelson, you know, the more he puts himself in these conversations, the more he puts himself in these tournaments and doesn't close it out, is that a positive, or is what he said to NBC after the round where he said it doesn't feel good to get second, is it a detriment? I mean, is it a kick to the gut when every time you're there, you come up a shot or two shy, and the gap between your last win looms larger and larger?
It cuts both ways, really. But again, you know, if he was blowing four footers, think of Freddie at Augusta, where he would always get himself there on Saturday and even Sunday, and then he would just wither. You know, that leaves scar tissue. You know, he's doing that at field age. That's damaging. But Phil's playing terrific. I mean, he didn't make a bogey on Sunday. He's still cleaning up with a short putt. I think these are mostly positives. No doubt it's getting frustrating and irritating to Phil. And in the moment when he walks off the course, he's steaming mad. But I think with a little reflection, I mean, he's going to blow into Baltusrol with a ton of momentum. And, you know, that's all due to his fine play at Troon. So I think they're mostly positive. But certainly, this keeps going on, you start wondering if your time really is up. So the sooner he can win one, the better, obviously.
And when you look at Phil's season, 10 top 25s and 17 starts, he's finished second three times, six top 10s. He's fourth in strokes gained putting, and fourth in strokes gained total in all stats. Do you think that Phil, you even mentioned it, you said he's getting in that 40-year-old range where it's tougher to close out events. Do you think Phil could be the first player to get into his 50s and still contend consistently, not just in the majors, not just at the Masters, but in events? Because it seems that length isn't an issue for him, and as long as the short game's somewhat sharp, he's able to play in pretty much any event on any golf course.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, his game travels now because he's driving it straighter. And I think with Phil, he's a golf romantic. He plays his best when he's inspired. That happens at Augusta National. That happens at Pebble Beach. It happened at Marion. There's places that speak to him, the courses and events, and, Torrey Pines. It just brings out the best in him. Obviously, Phoenix. You can go down the list. The places that he has a love affair with, the tournaments, the people, the golf courses. So that's what's interesting is, he's always been very up and down. Because I think a lot of tournaments he gets to, he's like, what am I doing here? I'd rather be on the beach at Del Mar. And he's just kind of going through the motion and working on things for the next tournament he really cares about. But the sustained excellence he's had this year, week in, week out, is almost unprecedented for, as you go back to very early in his career. It's exciting to think what he can do, going forward. I think Phil loves, kind of fallen in love with the game again this year. I think there were some periods in the last 2 years preceding where he was really frustrated, and I think now he's just fired up when he gets there. He knows he's close. He wants another win so much that he's bringing a little extra fire. So as long as this motivation and this passion is there, I mean, I don't see any reason why he can't just keep going.
And you mentioned he's a golf romantic, and you mentioned places that motivate him and get him excited. And of course, the major championship I go to immediately is the U.S. Open. I mean, it's the one that's got away over the course of his career. I mean, let me list off, let me just list off the future sites for people that don't know. Next year's Erin Hills, which is an unknown to most players. But then Phil gets Shinnecock, Pebble Beach, Wingfoot, and Torrey in a row. I know he's getting close to 50, and he'll be 50 for probably, I guess, the 2021 at Torrey, but these are golf courses that Phil's had plenty of success at in the past. He's won on some of these golf courses, and he's contended in U.S. Opens there. Would you say, come 2022, would you be more surprised if Phil didn't win a U.S. Open, considering the venues, or would you be, less surprised if he did?
That's a really good question. I mean, I thought for sure he was going to win Pebble last time around. And the thing about Pebble Beach, it can't get any longer. It's hemmed in. So it's always going to play short for these guys. And, you know, that means Phil's hardly, there's very few drivers he has to hit. And, you know, tiny greens that really put, everyone misses greens at Pebble, so it's all about short game. I still feel like, you know, he's won there four times during the Clam Bake. I still feel like Pebble's his best shot venue-wise. You know, Shinnecock is more golf course, more drivers. Now, this new Phil who's driving it in play, you know, maybe that changes the calculus a little bit. But, you know, he has beef with Shinnecock. You know, he played some of the best golf of his life there in 2004. And your Chief Goosen made a series of putts that were improbable, to say the least. And then Phil made just one mistake on the 71st hole, and he took double bogey out of that bunker. And he really should have won that tournament by three or four shots, as good as he played, and he knows that. And, you know, Phil's a New York guy. He hangs out in Long Island. He's out in the Hamptons. You know, that's a place that he has those good feelings for. So I would expect a spirited run at Shinny, certainly Pebble. You know, it's interesting that since Jones redid Torrey Pine, Phil doesn't like the golf course, and he's lost some of his affection for the place, and it's shown his performance. He really, I don't think he's won since the redesign, and does a lot of grumbling. It's kind of like that was a special place to him, and it's been desecrated. And you know, we all remember last time he played without a driver, he was like 50 yards behind Tiger and Adam Scott in every hole. It's like one of the weirdest things ever. 7,400 yards at sea level, and he didn't put a driver in play. But I don't think that Torrey Pine is a slam dunk that it might have been. But I look at Shinnecock and Pebble as the two best shots. I guess I still believe it's going to happen, even though I'm not sure Phil believes it. You know, the last couple opens, he really hasn't factored. And I don't know if I think there was a time where he felt like it was his best shot. And I think maybe the sense of inevitability is creeping in. But I guess 51% of me said he's gonna pick one off.
that's as safe a bet as you can make. 51-49. By the way, do the insiders call it Shinny? Because I've never heard that.
Well, the cool kids do.
Okay, yeah. I'm still on the outside looking in. I don't know that. I talked about this on my Monday podcast with Scott Van Pelt, but and you mentioned a couple of them. You know, Phil's had some devastating second place finishes in majors. You know, when you look back, I mean. Stinson, Spieth, you mentioned, Shinnecock. He had a chance to beat Darren Clark at that Open that Darren Clark surprisingly won. David Thom shoots a record number at the PGA. You know, there's not really many second-place finishes for Phil at these majors where he wasn't at least in the conversation late into Sunday. And I think one of the things people say about Phil or said about Phil early in his career was this guy wasn't a closer. And if you look over the last 10 years or so, he's been a closer in all of these types of situations. I mean, you think about Baltusrol, he birdies 18. You think about the way he closed out Muirfield. You think about some of these Masters. You know, he's been very, very clutch in major championships, and I think it's funny that he's kind of bucked the trend earlier in his career and now is one of those guys that late into final rounds, he puts himself in position and makes putts and hits golf shots.
Well, sure. I mean, his wins have been so dramatic, starting of course, with the walk-off birdie in 04 Masters. But there's been some mistakes. Geez, I think about 2012 Augusta when he made that triple on number 4, you know, playing right-handed. And he had tripled number 10, I think, on Saturday. It's like, again, that's probably one he should have won comfortably. You know, Shinnecock taking a double bogey on a fairly short par 3 on the 71st hole. Marion probably is the one that hurts the most. You know, he's carrying 5 wedges, and he somehow chooses the wrong one on a 110-yard hole. makes another bogey with a wedge in his hand later on the back 9. This is after holing out on Sunday, figuring, you know, that he was destined to be darling. So his victories have been, and of course, we haven't mentioned Wingfoot, which is, you know, the archetype of the still disappointment. So his wins have been incredibly memorable and dramatic, but so have his losses, and that's just what makes Phil so compelling. I do think you can't win 40-plus tournaments and not be a closer. I mean, certainly he's not afraid of the moment. He knows how to get it done. But there's always been that little bit of wobbliness in his long game, especially that that I think has cost him. Now, if he's going to start hitting it like Ben Hogan, and he can still chip and putt, then who knows what's going to happen. But, you know, it's that's why it feels fun to watch. There's just you're holding your breath. He's not. I mean, no one ever will be like Tiger, but certainly Phil. They do it in a different way. You know, Tiger's very. People think of Tiger as this overwhelming talent and the crazy flop shots and the big cuts around trees. And I mean, he could play those shots, but he was a very conservative golfer at the majors, and that was the secret. He just didn't make mistakes. He avoided three putts. He just kept grinding for pars. And just wore people down. You know, Phil's never been that guy, and that's partly why he's so beloved. He's just more fun to watch this thing.
Yeah, and I mean, so far we've been doing this for about 15 minutes, and you've mentioned that he played a 7,400-yard golf course with no driver. He famously had two drivers in the bag, and he had five wedges at a U.S. Open. For all the years you've covered golf, has there been someone that you've enjoyed covering more than Phil? I mean, I guess you could probably say Tiger, but Tiger doesn't give you what Phil gives you.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, Tiger at his peak, there's never been anything more thrilling, obviously in golf, maybe not even in sports. I mean, I think about, you know, following him and Bob May in the playoff inside the ropes at Valhalla. I could barely breathe. You know, the coming down the stretch at Torrey, same thing. Like, I remember trying to write something on my notebook with my pen, and I actually like snapped my pen. I was like gripping it so tight from the tension, you know. It was just like Tiger did things that'll never be done again by any man, woman, or extraterrestrial. So, but at the same time, to your point, he didn't let us in. You know, he was very difficult to cover as a reporter. The sports are around his inner self, and even the people around him, you know, his agent, his caddy. They were not easy to deal with. His wife was mute. Whereas, you know, Phil's got this collection of storytellers, whether it's Butch Harmon or Bone, you know, going even back to Rick Smith, obviously Amy Middleton, America's Sweetheart. I mean, just the people around Phil have great energy. And you can walk with him for 2 hours on the golf course and fill up your notebook. And so from a professional standpoint, it's way easier to write about Phil and more reporting. And, you know, we saw it. I'm sure you saw some of his press conferences at Trude. I mean, that's that. He's just got that mischievous twinkle in his eye the whole time. And that's kind of the energy he brings to these events. And, you know, Tiger is a much more foreboding kind of enigmatic presence. So, yeah, I mean, I think I've done five cover stories on Phil. I've done a bunch of other big pieces. There's definitely no one who's more fun to write about and more fun to watch.
Do you think that Phil is a top 10 player of all time as of right now?
He's knocking on the door, I mean, for sure. When you look, the difference between five majors and six or five majors and seven, I mean, it's meaningful. But when you look at the longevity, I mean, I'd say Lee Trevino had a very compressed career. You know, Phil chasing him on majors, but it's hard to say that Trevino had a better career. I mean, Phil's done it for a quarter century. If you look at things like, you know, 11 Ryder Cup teams, every President's Cup team since inception, obviously the U.S. has had mixed results, but just the consistency that Phil has brought for so long is impressive. And, you know, even the second and third places in the majors, it speaks to how often he's been there. Now, of course, for his ultimate legacy, it would be very helpful if he picked off a few more, but I'd have to think on that a little further. But he's definitely, he's probably T10.
That's what I
have. How long the list is.
That's what I have him. I have him at a 10 or 11, and I went over my list about 12 different times before I could land on where I had him at.
Yeah. You know, winning the U.S. Open, that was. You know, to get the career Grand Slam, that would set us to a different stratosphere. But, you know, someone said, you know, oh, it's devastating that he didn't get that sixth major to, you know, the Ty Faldo. And said, I don't know. I mean, Phil's legacy is pretty secure. Anything he gets from here on is pure gravy.
And, you know, when you think about Phil Mickelson, and I saw you mentioning this on Twitter earlier today, but, you know, you think about Phil Mickelson at 46, the Olympics are back, Tiger not playing in the Olympics. It would have been something he could have put on his resume that maybe Tiger never had. I mean, of course, Jack and those guys never had it. Do you think Phil was really trying to make this Olympic team for Team USA?
Oh, 1,000,000%. It was deeply important to him. He wanted to take his kids. He wanted to march in Olympic ceremonies. You know, he saw it as a legacy builder, and he saw it as a great family adventure. I mean, whenever I see him, it was wind up walking and talking about kids. And, I never print any of this stuff because it's not really for publication, but she tells me about all their family adventures. I mean, they travel the world. When Phil's not playing golf, they're off in a distant land. I mean, you know, Damien, she'll just take a daughter to Egypt for 2 weeks, and, you know, Phil takes someone to Costa Rica. They love it, an adventure, that family. And I think that's what Phil saw with the Olympics. I bet he would have stayed in the Olympic Village. You know, he would have been one of the oldest Olympians ever, right? I mean, I haven't looked at the list, but at 46, I mean, he would have beaten up the entire thing. So it's really a shame the way, you know, if you were just going on world ranking points one this year, he would have made the team easily. So he just had a slow start because he didn't have a lot of big results in 2015. But it's really too bad because he would have been a great ambassador for the Stars and Stripes, and he would have cried during the opening ceremonies, and he would have played so hard to get that gold medal. And if he got it, it would have meant the world to him. So I was bummed out he didn't squeak on the team because it was very close. And if the qualifying deadline had been moved back 1 week and it included the open results, he would have been on the team as well. So I mean, that's how close it was.
And it seems, again, and you just talking about this, you know, it seems like another error by the Olympic Committee with golf is not pushing it back towards the major that comes right before the Olympics. I mean, I think you could almost include the PGA Championship. It's not like these guys have to worry about flight plans or anything. I mean, they can afford a new ticket or a first-class ticket down there. I just, when you say all that and you mention some of those stats, it's even more of a bummer that Phil Mickelson isn't there, because I do believe that in the current golf state, Phil, when he's in contention or when he's playing in something, is about the biggest draw out there.
Yeah, I mean, compared to, you know, Pat Kuchar or Patrick Reed, I mean, come on, it's not even close. And yeah, I mean, let's be honest, the men's competition at the Olympics needs star power badly, and Phil would have provided that in spades. So it's a big loss. You know, deadlines are deadlines. You can already fill in plenty of chances to earn more points, and it's a putt here and it's a putt there. So, but yeah, it would have, just like, it was cool that for the women's, the deadline fell right after the U.S. Open. So you had like, you know, players were trying to win the U.S. Open, but they're also thinking about the Olympics, and it added a tournament in the tournament. And it would have added another dimension to the Open Championship, which, of course, is the best international event as it is. So it was kind of a missed opportunity. I'm not sure what went into the decision of making that deadline, but it is unfortunate.
And you're going to Rio, so I wanted to ask a couple of Olympic questions. First, on a scale from 1 to 10, what's your excitement level about golf in the Olympics, considering the names that are in it and the names that are not in it?
Well, you know, it's probably the same as the average Brazilian girl walking down the beach. I mean, it's about a 9.5. you know, I'm excited about. I've been a tireless advocate for the Olympics. I've taken a lot of shrapnel on Twitter, but so be it. I just think it's the biggest athletic event in the world. Why would you not want to be part of it? I mean, golf is a dying boutique sport. Courses are closing. When all the baby boomers croak here in the next 10 years or so, the participation rates are going to fall off a cliff in this country. If you want a healthy equipment industry, if you want to support all these great resorts like Bandon Dune, you need new customers, you need new markets. And that's not here in the U.S. That's in India, that's in China, that's in Brazil. And in those places, 99.9% of the population does not know what the PGA Championship is. But the gold medal is a cultural universal. And, you know, if one of the Indian guys in the field wins the Olympics, you can bet it's going to be a huge you know, if he wins gold, it's going to be a monumental deal in the entire subcontinent. Because let's face it, India does not win a lot of gold medals in the Olympics. There's going to be golf academies. There's going to be government funding. They're going to be building courses. They're going to be buying golf clubs. They're going to be flying over here to play golf courses. And so, you know, all these players who enjoy getting paid by the likes of TaylorMade, which, oh, by the way, is for sale, you know, everything is pointing in the wrong direction to this entire industry and sport. And here's an easy opportunity to introduce it to the entire world. And to punt on that, to me, is just flabbergasting. And it's a huge missed opportunity. And, you know, these guys want all the fame, the money, the spoils, but to give a little bit back is asking too much. I find the whole thing ridiculous. And, you know, I'm going down there. I'm going to miss my daughter's birthday. I'm going to miss the start of the school year. You know, it's not going to, I'm sure I'm going to be in traffic jams that are, you know, 3 hours each way into the course. I mean, it's not going to be the easiest fortnight. But I'm going because I think it's a big deal, and I'm part of this sport, and I want to chronicle it, and I believe it's an important moment. So, and I'm saying for both competitions, you know, these guys just fly in for, you know, normal tournament week. So, you know, I'm not saying it's like the ultimate sacrifice, but it's just part of the job. It's part of being in this sport, and so yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I hope Heinrich or you know, Ricky or Sergio wins, because as we know, the men's field is pretty thin. It'd be great to get one of the bigger names to do it. But at the same time, it'd be awesome if it's a real Cinderella story and it has an impact in a part of the world that doesn't have a long golf history. That'd be very meaningful too. So whoever wins, it's going to be a huge deal. And we all know the women are excited and they're going to put on a great show. And it's cool that they're getting more of the spotlight. They deserve it with just the passion they brought to this whole thing. So I think it's still going to be successful. It's still going to be fun. The golf course is going to be awesome. It's going to be great on TV. And I think the players who didn't go, they're ultimately going to really regret it.
And do you think there's something that can be tweaked in 4 years that maybe lightens the schedule up a bit for the men or moves a major or does something to where there's really no excuse for them except for, frankly, I don't want to play in the Olympics?
Yeah, I mean, they could move the PGA to the, you know, to early September. It's not a Ryder Cup year. Add a little air to the summertime schedule. That would help. You know, they still have the option to change the format. So in 2017, there'll be a vote on golf's place in the game. And the IGF could present a whole different format with two-man teams, best ball, any number of different scenarios. But changing the format's complicated, you know. I mean, look at, like, Suzanne Pedersen. She has a very good chance to win a gold medal. If you make her play with the second-best player for Norway, who's probably some college kid somewhere, her chances at medaling go way down. And you're pretty much eliminating every country except for a handful in any kind of team format, because the second best player is often pretty weak, you know, if you're not talking about the U.S. or England or Australia or South Africa. So everyone loves the idea of a team format, but the practicality is it eliminates so many good players from the chance to medal. If you do individual match play, but you get down to the semifinals, you have four players. You've lost most of your star power has been eliminated, as we see it, you know, at the World Match Play Championship. You got four guys left, three are going to win a medal. I'm not sure how much dramatic tension there is in that either. So stroke play is not imaginative, but it guarantees that all the players will be around. It opens the door for the real outsider to make a run at a medal, and it's probably the most equitable way to determine who the winner is. So there's things they can do. Whether they'll elect to do them, I don't know.
Well, Alan, I we talked Tiger, we talked Phil, we talked Olympics. I do want to ask you one final thing, and I want you to give us your best Phil Mickelson story that you're allowed to say.
Oh, man, there's so many good ones. I don't know if I should tell this one or not.
Tell it. I already can tell it's going to be good.
Okay. So we're at the Open at the Old Course last year. I was filming this video thing for golf.com out by the first tee. It was the very end of play, and Phil had a super late tee time on Thursday. And so he just putted out at probably 8:30 or something. And he's walking back down the first fairway, cutting over to the Old Course Hotel. And so he saw me, gave me a little head nod. So I walked over and I walked with him, and we crossed, waved to the last group to play the roll hole, and we just crossed the fairway, and we just stood in the lobby talking. And we had this whole, he was talking about, I'm not going to say who, but it's the college-age son of a well-known golf figure, and he's kind of adventuring this kid. And we got into this whole thing about giving this kid advice on dating. And so he said, okay, you go to the best-looking girl, and you just have to ask her lots of questions, and here's the key, you have to actually listen to the answers, and you have to pretend like you're really into the conversation. He's like, that's how I nabbed Amy. It works every time. No one ever talks to these girls. And like, it's painful. You know, you got to listen. You actually have to pretend you care, but you do. It works. And I said, no, that's really good advice. And then he proceeded to tell me that this kid was now dating the daughter of an extremely high-ranking politician who I cannot say for fear of a drone strike, but ultimately, you know, he had to break up with her because she was smoking too much pot, and it was kind of a bummer. We were just kind of hanging out. This was apropos of nothing. I was like, I've just gotten two of the best pieces of information from a golfer in the last 10 minutes that I ever have. And he's like, all right, I gotta go eat dinner. See you later. And then he just disappears into the night. But if I can tell you who this daughter was, it's monumental. But of course, I can't.
Yeah. But Phil says talk to him. That goes a little bit different than the whole Tiger asking MJ and Barkley how to approach women in the whole story.
Yeah. That was great. I mean, but then, you know, how he has gossip about, you know, inside the Beltway gossip. It's just classic Phil. You know, I remember standing on the putting green at Pebble Beach, and we were talking about something, and then Baker Finch walks by. He's like, hold on a second, I got to finish the conversation with him. And they'd been talking about black holes and antimatter and, you know, universes colliding. And it's like Stephen Hawking stuff they're talking, and they're so into it. And Bolton runs down the hill there from the first. He's like, Phil, I'm a tee in 2 minutes, come on, man. And, I mean, Phil would have missed his tee time because he was so into this astrophysics conversation. And, you know, this is the putting green at Pebble Beach. This is how it is. Oh, this reminds me. This takes me to an Ian Poulter anecdote, who told me that that at one of the Ryder Cup dinners, Poulter convinced everyone to agree to gang up on Phil and insist that the lunar landing had been staged and it was done, you know, a set in Hollywood. Everybody knows that. And if Phil thinks that, you know, Neil Armstrong really walked on the moon, he's crazy. And so there's like both teams were insisting to Phil that this is a commonly known fact, and that it was, and Phil was just so flummoxed by the whole thing. And I mean, there's so many Phil stories, it's ridiculous, but we're already boring your listeners, Shane.
No, I love any Phil story. This is a guy that changes putting grips during the final round of the Open Championship when he's in the final group. He is an anomaly. I'm not sure we'll ever see anybody come close to Phil Mickelson in the sense of professional golf. I mean, not just the way he acts and the way his mind works, but, you know, winning an event as amateur in 1991 and still being a factor in 2016. Alan, I appreciate the time. Thank you for chatting with us on the drive, and we look forward to the PGA coverage and coverage from Rio. It'll be fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me. It's good fun. See you soon.
And that'll do it for this week. I appreciate Alan Shipnuck, of course, SI, great rider. Make sure you check out all of his stuff as we get closer to Baltusrol and as he heads down to Rio. I know he's really excited. You heard he said he's at 9.5 out of 10 excited about getting a chance to cover the Olympics, getting a chance to cover golf in the Olympics. So I appreciate him jumping on. Appreciate you guys listening, writing reviews, subscribing, all that good stuff. If you want to get a hold of me, you can jump on Twitter @ShaneBacon. @ the Clubhouse Pod. You can use the hashtag Clubhouse SB If you have questions, comments, or anything, pictures, anything, if you know Gorse the Horse, send anything you know along my way. And of course, longer questions or longer comments, you can send it in to the Clubhouse with Shane Bacon at gmail.com, which is still the longest email address on the planet. Thanks, guys. Have a great week.